Jim Siegler here for Brainwaves, and today we have another episode of Teaching Through Clinical Cases. It's an interesting case of a 23-year-old male who was admitted to our institution with a rapidly progressive worsening of lower extremity paresthesias and ataxia. Dr. Michael Rubenstein, an assistant professor of neurology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, will be walking us through the case.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So let's get started. This 23-year-old male presented to clinical attention with 3 weeks of worsening numbness and paresthesias that began in his feet and then ascended rapidly to involve his stomach and his chest. There was no antecedent trauma, no headache, or occupational exposure. He worked as a valet for a restaurant in the city. He denied any associated weakness or incontinence of stool or urine, but eventually his gait deteriorated and he sustained several falls, particularly while ascending or descending stairs. As a valet, he also noticed more difficulty engaging the depth of gas pedals and switching from the gas to the brake. He denied any family history of any similar symptoms, no family history of autoimmune diseases. He denied tobacco use and rarely consumed alcohol. He had been in a stable relationship over the last 3 years and denied any other sexual partners. His only medications included Tylenol, which he rarely took for headache, and Benadryl, which he used for sleep at night. He had no allergies.
I'm very intrigued by this case. In a previously healthy male without obvious exposure history, the differential diagnosis for rapidly progressive disturbance in sensation ataxia is broad. Inflammatory diseases of the peripheral nerves like Guillain-Barré syndrome must be considered as they lead to progressive weakness and life-threatening respiratory insufficiency. The time course is too slow and progressive for traumatic or vascular insults, such as a posterior spinal artery infarct, which would be unusual in a young and otherwise healthy male. Similarly, many inflammatory lesions of the spinal cord would also manifest more quickly than what we are observing in this gentleman. Therefore, I'm not considering disorders like neuromyelitis optica, multiple sclerosis, neurosarcoidosis, or transverse myelitis. Conversely, the time course is much too quick for neoplastic or toxic diseases of the spinal cord.
Extradural spinal cord tumors like epidural meningiomas and intrinsic spinal cord tumors like astrocytomas often present more indolently with a spastic paraparesis. Zinc toxicity, usually seen in patients who take high doses of certain nutritional supplements, or in the elderly who surreptitiously ingest older denture creams, or disorders of malabsorption, such as bariatric surgery, can result in a copper deficiency myelopathy. B12 deficiency, as in the case of pernicious anemia or veganism, results in an equally indolent posterior column myelopathy called subacute combined degeneration.
The slowness of symptomatic progression and lack of B-type symptoms do not fit with infectious causes of myelopathy, which you have reviewed in a prior podcast. Most infectious causes of myelopathy typically present more rapidly if the lesions are intrinsic to the spinal cord. Chronic HIV produces a vacuolar myelopathy affecting the dorsal columns and lateral cortical spinal tract, but you're telling me he explicitly denied weakness. Neurosyphilis can cause a characteristic excruciating back pain with progressive posterior column myelopathy, the syndrome of Tabes dorsalis, but the sensory ataxia of this disorder evolves over months to years. Tell me about his exam.
The general examination was unremarkable. His mentation was appropriate, and cranial nerves, including the extraocular movements, were normal, with normal saccades and smooth pursuit. The arms and legs were strong, with only mild weakness of dorsiflexion of the bilateral ankles as well as eversion and inversion. He exhibited a severe sensory ataxia on finger to nose and heel to shin.
A sensory ataxia is observed when coordination is more impaired with eyes shut and may improve with eyes open, as opposed to the optic ataxia of Bullent syndrome, which is present only with the eyes open because of a defect in the wear pathway. But in general, we think of ataxia as a cerebellar process, which means symptoms are present and similar regardless of whether the eyes are open or shut.
Sensation to vibration and proprioception was also grossly impaired in the feet and knees, but not in the hands. He appreciated temperature just fine throughout, and there was a sensory level to pinprick at about the T5 level. Reflexes were slightly brisk, as might be expected in a 23-year-old. Hoffman's sign was absent, and the plantar responses were flexor bilaterally. His stance was normal, and gait was wide-based. He was unable to tandem walk, and the Romberg sign was present.
The exam is consistent with the disorder of the dorsal and possibly lateral columns at this point, given the T5 sensory level, sensory ataxia and loss of vibration and position sensation. So my greatest suspicion is for an inflammatory posterior spinal cord process and less likely a peripheral neuropathy. What were his initial labs?
The serum chemistry and liver function was normal. He had a mild anemia with a hemoglobin of 12.8 milligrams per deciliter and a normal mean corpuscular volume.
Well, I do not suspect this patient has a chronic B12 or copper deficiency to account for a posterior column myelopathy. The CBC can sometimes aid in the differentiation.
An elevated MCV can indicate B12 or folate deficiency, both of which can contribute to spinal cord disease, whereas copper deficiency is associated with a microcytic sideroblastic anemia and neutropenia. Interestingly, if a hematologist were to hear that finding from a blood smear, they might suspect a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome. In fact, there have been many case reports of misdiagnoses of copper deficiency with MDS in the literature.
What other laboratory testing would you send?
I would start with an HIV B12 level, and if on the low to normal side, would follow with the methylmalonic acid level, folate, serum copper, ANA, and RPR. If these were normal, I might consider a second-tier panel, including an SPEP with immunofixation, SSA and SSB, Lyme titer, ESR, CRP, and rheumatoid factor. He should also have an MRI of his brain, cervical, and thoracic spine, with and without gadolinium, to look for intrinsic cord disease. An EMG may be helpful for distinguishing a sensory neuropathy, as in the case of Sjogren's or anti-HU paraneoplastic disease or other forms of polyneuropathy, but I would not order this test just yet.
His brain MRI was normal, but the thoracic MRI showed T2 prolongation of the dorsal columns at the level of the fourth thoracic vertebrae extending to the conus. HIV, folate, serum copper, ANA, and RPR were all normal. A B12 level was normal at 487 picograms per milliliter, and the MMA was elevated at 10 times the normal value.
A B12 level less than 200 picograms per milliliter is 90% sensitive and 60 to 80% specific for detecting B12 deficiency. So a follow-up with serum methylmalonic acid is recommended. Methylmalonic acid levels greater than 400 nanomoles per liter are also highly sensitive for confirming B12 deficiency, on the order of 98% sensitive, but are even less sensitive and can be misrepresented in patients with renal failure and dehydration.
Taken together, this patient has the clinical characteristics of a B12 deficiency myeloneuropathy, with elevation of his methylmalonic acid, although his B12 level was normal. The lack of cord enhancement may help distinguish inflammatory causes of myelopathy, like NMO and MS, from infectious causes, but his symptoms have progressed over weeks. So gadolinium enhancement might not be expected at this point. It is important to realize that B12 deficiency myelopathy may be clinically indistinguishable from copper deficiency, so this must be excluded. Folic acid deficiency may also present with subacute combined degeneration, so it is important that you rule this out. Less commonly, vitamin E deficiency can produce a myelopathy or cerebellar ataxia with or without ophthalmoparesis, but this is far less common. My next question is, how did he become so functionally deficient of cobalamin?
It just so happens that in subsequent interviews, the patient confessed to abusing Whippets, or inhaled nitrous oxide, quite regularly. It would give him just enough of a short 1 to 2 minute high in between car pickups and drop-offs as a valet that it would not interfere with his work. So this patient had normal B12 levels in the serum. How is it possible that he had a B12 deficiency myeloneuropathy?
Well, interestingly, nitrous oxide abuse can rapidly deplete functional B12 stores by irreversibly oxidizing the cobalt and methylcobalamin, the active form of B12. The most commonly used method of testing serum B12 does not differentiate between the active and inactive forms of this vitamin, and therefore normal B12 levels do not necessarily rule out a deficiency. Another cause of toxic myelopathy from recreational drug use not particularly associated with B12 deficiency includes heroin abuse, also called chasing the dragon. This is an especially interesting clinical entity because of how rapid these patients decline after heroin inhalation. Following a brief period of ataxia and dysarthria, patients often progress to spastic paraparesis, coma, or akinetic mutism. The MRI can be completely normal at first, which is shocking to neurologists, but if repeated after 1 to 2 weeks, a diffuse leukoencephalopathy becomes obvious on the flare sequence. Treatment with coenzyme Q may be beneficial here, but these patients first and foremost need substance abuse counseling. For our patient with cobalamin deficiency, treatment begins with B12 injections.
What is the prognosis for this patient?
In early reports of nitrous oxide abuse, we did not know that there was a relationship between consumptive B12 deficiency and the myelopathy, so B12 repletion was not offered. Even in those patients, recovery with near normalization was the expected outcome. The good thing is our patient did not complain of significant weakness, although we did appreciate some weakness at the ankles on our exam. In the case reports I've come across, most patients make a good recovery over a period of months with very minimal, if any, deficits at 1 year. The T2 signal change on MRI also resolves during this time period.
So, Mike, you do have a personal experience with this kind of a syndrome. I think that you are one of the first people to describe the relationship between a B12 deficiency or a consumption of B12 by nitrous oxide use in a case of myeloneuropathy.
Early in my career, it was very interesting that a patient was referred to me after she had had surgery, but 6 months later, and she had a spastic periparesis. And during my evaluation of the patient, I determined that the patient was actually deficient in vitamin B12, but was still unable to determine why the surgical procedure had precipitated this myeloneuropathy. After attending a board review course where it was discussed that nitrous oxide can actually cause a condition of subacute combined degeneration by making patients effectively B12 deficient, I found that the patient had actually received nitrous oxide during her induction for anesthesia. Looking back at her pre-admission laboratory studies, it was clear that she was B12 deficient from hematologic parameters prior to her surgery, but had no symptoms of B12 deficiency before the surgery, and it was actually receiving the nitrous oxide induction that caused her to become functionally deficient and develop the myeloneuropathy.
Very helpful review, Mike. Thanks so much for taking us through the case.
My pleasure.
Again, that was Dr. Michael Rubenstein at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. You might have recognized his voice from the episode we did on the FAME clinic in Tanzania, which he operates.
We got stood down by a bull elephant this last trip that normally you don't want to take out a bull elephant.
If you haven't heard it yet, check it out. I definitely recommend it. That's all for Brainwaves today. I'm Jim Siegler. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Brainwaves today. If you like what you just heard, you can find more related material on the web at brainwaves.me or find us on Twitter at brainwavesaudio. Feel free to contact us at bweditorialboard@gmail.com. Be sure to check out our iTunes archive for older episodes. This episode was produced by Jim Siegler. Music by Marcos H. Bolanos. I'm Erica Mejia. Join us next time for another edition of Brainwaves.